There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello, welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Sunday, October the 13th. We're asking, though, who is paying for your health insurance?
What you're getting from your company and if it's enough in the way of health benefits. We know that a lot of industries tightening their belts. Our healthcare benefits, one of the things that are getting tightened. We've been speaking this morning to Jerome Deutsch, who is the Chief Executive Officer for this region at Cigna, the insurance people. And one of the things that we asked him was whether or not he's seeing an uptick in employees topping up their insurance or even buying their own. This is what he said.
We've seen it, and actually what is very interesting is when I looked at the individual solution, so we have designed exactly the same plan as the one you can get through your employers with an individual policy. And we've seen really an increasing demand. Our sales have grown more than 70% this year compared to last year. So a massive increase in terms of individual solution. And I think the good thing about it is the fact that you can really tailor-made your own solution based on your needs. And you can also, for instance, provide a worldwide cover if you want to be covered for your family or your children whenever they are going back home.
We've also been speaking to Stephen McLaren, who's the Director of Employee Benefits at AES International. And we asked him where we were at the moment in terms of what companies are willing to pay for when it comes to employee insurance schemes.
I think we're in the spiral downwards in terms of companies not covering as much as they used to. We've got far too many healthcare providers, brokers, insurance companies, the lot, and it's really causing a problem in the market in terms of inflation. So medical inflation over the last 4 years is well over 10%, and that's every year. So that puts a lot of pressure on companies to look at the bottom line.
But we've been asking you what you are experiencing. A number of people getting in touch with us to talk about what they're finding, what they're buying, what their company's actually giving them. We've heard from one person who says that she gets basic cover from her company, but then pays an extra 3,000 dirhams a year to upgrade for better coverage. But, she says, the upgrade supplement differs depending on who you are. Her supplement, for example, because she's married, she's 41, is a lot more than a colleague in her 20s. Other people paying different amounts. And how insurance is calculated has actually become a little bit of a bugbear amongst listeners. This is Shah, who would like to see the way that insurance companies calculate their premiums changing.
When the government declared a couple of years ago that every resident will have to have an insurance policy, I obviously approached some insurers, and I was told that because of my age, which was then 73, I would have to pay something like 40,000 as an annual premium. Now, luckily, the government postponed it by a year, and I got into a group insurance for my company. But a friend of mine who is 68 has had a stroke, has had an angiography, and is actually doddering around. He's not very active. He's all that. He's paying me about 8,500 as his annual premium. So it's a very stupid way of calculating premiums purely based on age and not on your health condition.
Very candid views there from Shah. Thanks very much indeed. We've also heard today from our colleague Zina, who is the producer of The Agenda. And Zina says that insurance should be streamlined across the Emirates.
Okay, so my husband works in Abu Dhabi, so our nanny's visa is an Abu Dhabi one. That means her insurance has to come from Abu Dhabi, and we live in Dubai, so she has to travel to Abu Dhabi every time she has a checkup, her medical, etc. And she has a condition, so that means she has to visit a hospital in Abu Dhabi at least once a month. So when I inquired at the insurance company about extending it to Dubai, they said, yeah, sure, it's an additional 22,000, which I think anybody would think that's crazy, right?
22 grand.
Yes, Zina, we do think it's crazy. You should have seen the facial reactions here in the Business Breakfast studio. We're going to look now at pre-existing conditions. We've had a number of people getting in touch with us about the fact that they're now paying for their own health insurance. And a lot of people, of course, will do so if they go freelance or if they go and set up their own company. All of a sudden, you're outside of your firm's safety net. We're joined on the line now by Jonathan Rawling, the CFO of Yalla Compare. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you again.
What do people need to keep in mind when it comes to pre-existing conditions?
Yeah, I think there's one really, really, the most important thing, advice I can ever give on pre-existing conditions is you have to disclose them. So whereas a lot of people think that pre-existing conditions are automatically covered, that's only partially true. We've had a couple of unfortunate examples with the Ala Compare customers that have, in filling out their medical disclosures, they've not said or not admitted to something. And then when they tried to claim against that thing, that those claims have been denied. So pre-existing conditions will be covered as long as you're honest in that medical disclosure. And if you are honest in that medical disclosure, the unfortunate thing is you will be charged extra premium for those conditions.
Which is a cost that some of our guests this morning have been saying people don't necessarily take into account, do they, when they are going out to work for themselves?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, the difference between a premium for somebody that doesn't have a condition and somebody that does can really be quite dramatic. So if you are thinking about striking out on your own and you have some pre-existing condition, I would really advise people just to find out what the insurance options are first and make sure that you fully understand that cost before you take the jump.
Are there rules and regulations about what insurance companies have to do when it comes to pre-existing conditions? I mean, is it a case that they have to cover you, but it just depends for how much money?
That's right. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that insurers are not allowed to deny cover for a pre-existing condition. But what they can do, that I don't think there are any specific rules around how much they can charge you for that condition. So they can price you out of it, if you like, but they can't deny you.
What are you guys seeing at Yalla Compare, Jonathan, when it comes to people taking out their own insurance or for themselves and their families rather than using the work insurance or even topping up?
So we see really two categories of people. So there, as I'm sure you know, there's the basic healthcare plan in this country, the mandatory one, and a lot of people are taking that just to tick the boxes so that they can proceed with the visa for their family. The other group of people are the ones that are actually buying the sort of deeper, you know, more extensive covers for their family. We actually don't see a lot of people topping up. We see really people falling into those two buckets. Either you're ticking the box to the visa or you're really trying to protect your family.
Jonathan Rawling from Yalla Compare, the CFO, thank you very much for joining us on the line.
Most welcome. Thank you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
So health insurance under the Business Breakfast microscope today. As times are tight, we're asking, are healthcare benefits being squeezed? We heard earlier from Jerome Drush, the regional boss of Cigna, also Stephen McLaren of the finance company AES, and they have seen an increase in people topping up their company insurance. Let's get a small business perspective on this now. Hazel Jackson is the CEO and indeed the owner of Biz Group. It's a training and development consultancy based here in Dubai with just over 50 employees. What is your medical insurance bill as a training company in Dubai with 54 people on the payroll?
It is 8,000 dirhams a head,
which adds up to
432k.
That is not insignificant.
I know, I was a bit shocked this morning when I did the numbers.
Had you never really done that number before?
I had done the numbers. In fact, actually, it's been a bit of a navigating a maze, medical insurance, over the last few years. And Malcolm, you're absolutely spot on. It was, on average, 10 to 12% increase year on year over the last 3 years. And so a couple of years ago, we started really negotiating as hard as we possibly could. At the same time, balancing out, you want people to have good medical cover here. I mean, ours is a premium cover, and we actually cover the team internationally. So if they have medical issues when they're home, then they're actually covered when they're at home. It's just for employees, though, not necessarily for dependents and spouses.
Did you question why there was a 10% increase?
Always. And they kept just saying medical costs are going up. We really negotiated as hard as we could. This year, maybe it would have been better if we'd found them a couple of years ago. We're using a broker to help us, a company called Bayzat, and they actually are negotiating on our behalf, and they negotiate on behalf of a lot of SMEs. So I think they have a better understanding of what's possible. But yeah, it's an expensive addition to a company. And because we're under 100 employees, as I understand it, we don't have the power of negotiation that perhaps a large company would have.
Hassan writes in, picking up on your point about the type of medical. He said you can go from 700 dirhams per person to 35,000 dirhams per person. And he's absolutely right. How did you strike that balance?
Look, I think one of the key things is being reassured that if something does happen, it's an insurance, isn't it? So you don't, you hope nobody's going to be sick. But you want to make sure if they are, that they're going to have the right cover in a hospital situation, in an emergency situation. So you start adding up all of those things when you look at the breakdown, then that ends up costing, particularly, I don't think we're covered in America, but basically we're covered anywhere else. The classic for me, though, is when you do that breakdown, I'm covered for maternity. Now, I know I'd love to think that I was still able to have a child, but I'm beyond that age. Yet because I'm female, regardless of my age, I have to have maternity cover.
All your female employees have it?
Yes. It doesn't make any sense to me, but it's a tick box. If you're female, then you must be able to be covered for that.
So in terms of what happens next in terms of medical insurance, because that's almost 500,000 dirhams a year, mm-hmm. that's costing you. What can you do to reduce that? I know you've hired a broker. Is there anything you can do to cut corners, or perhaps give a basic level of cover and ask your employees to top it up, as some people are doing?
So I think that's a choice. And I think, look, there's a lot of things that are tight in Dubai right now, but I believe employee welfare remains high on our agenda to make sure that they are safe and that they are covered and that it isn't at their expense on top of everything else to go out and make sure that in an emergency situation, they've had the foresight to cover themselves. So we will continue to cover that level of medical.
You're an SME, just over 50 employees, but you know, when you look at it on your books, I'm sure that 450,000 or whatever you're paying doesn't look like a small amount. Is that big enough to include things like pre-existing conditions and some of the more
Absolutely.
Exotic surgeries?
Yeah, I believe, I don't know whether they're exotic surgeries, but pre-existing conditions are always covered. I think that's one of the things in the UAE law, that you don't have to prove that you've had this condition before and therefore it's not covered. So yeah, we're very comprehensively covered. And what I like about the Bayzet team is they've also given us access to software and tools that make it much easier for the team to stay on top of their HR issues.
What are you seeing in terms of not just gender disparity, but also age disparity in some of your older employees? Can you track that?
Well, yeah, you can actually start to have a look. There's a lot you can ask for. They're not normally very forthcoming in giving you, you know, what you've spent the previous year. But you don't get it by person, but you can get it as a generic number. And obviously, the older you get, the more likely you are to have some medical care needs. So yeah, as our population stays with Biz Group as they get older, the premiums have gone up. So it really is about negotiating now.
And what about the alternative stuff? I mean, for treating stress and new treatments?
So I think one of the interesting things as well, this year's program is going to include a number of wellness sessions. So trying to look at preventative care rather than getting into, having to go to the doctor. So we are going to, I think, believe in this program that we will have this year, monthly wellness options to try and keep the employees as fit as possible.
Hazel Jackson, CEO of Biz Group. Always nice talking to you. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, Malcolm.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
You've been looking at a coin offering, haven't you, Rich?
Yeah, Dubai-based company Telegram, the messaging service. Here's the headline on Forbes. The SEC, that's the regulator on Wall Street, files an emergency restraining order against Telegram's $1.7 billion ICO or initial coin offering. It's a complicated one, this one, because they've basically already done it. So the Securities and Exchange Commission has filed the emergency action. It says it's got a temporary restraining order against Telegram, the encrypted messaging app, but it's already raised $1.7 billion, with a B, by selling tokens similar to Bitcoin that could be used on a future service. Now, here's what the complaint says. It says Telegram sold approximately 3 billion crypto tokens, called Grams, to 171 buyers around the world. Now, 39 of those buyers were in the United States, which is why the SEC is getting involved. It's the US Wall Street regulator. Now, Telegram, for its part, said it's going to launch its blockchain-powered service by the end of this month, and it's going to deliver the tokens before that time. It's kind of a bit high level and over my head to know what these coins are, what these tokens are, and what they're actually going to do. I know what Telegram is. It's a messaging service, and some of our colleagues use it. It's an encrypted messaging service. And Forbes says it's unclear whether the SEC will actually have any impact, because Telegram is based here. I'm looking on the Telegram website in their frequently asked questions section, and it says, where is Telegram based? And it says, Telegram development team is based in Dubai. Most of the developers behind Telegram originally come from St. Petersburg in Russia, but the development team is based here in Dubai. They say, we're currently happy with Dubai, although we are ready to relocate again if local regulations change. So it was set up by Russian entrepreneurs a while ago. A guy by the name of Pavel Durov and his brother Nikolai set it up, and they kind of support it. But where precisely that $1.7 billion has gone, whose pockets or whose bank account it goes into, isn't clear. More questions than answers about the Telegram coin offering.
Speaking of looking at local websites, I'm on darb.ae, and that is the new car sharing website that's just been set up in Abu Dhabi. An official Department of Transport-backed car sharing initiative just a couple of days before the road tolls go live in the capital. Will, for the first time, legally allow people to share cars. You can't pay someone for a lift, because at that point you become a private taxi, but you can share expenses, so people can chip in for the petrol and the road tolls. Would you do it quickly?
I would. It wouldn't be my first choice, but in theory, I would do it. It's like a lot of those things, though. Yeah, of course, I would do it. But unfortunately, I don't live near people, or I don't have circumstances that would lend myself to it. And that's the cop-out, isn't it? That's an easy cop-out. In theory, I would, but it doesn't work for me. Malk?
Would I do it if I was coming in from Sharjah? Yeah, probably, because it's a tough one. And rather than driving that traffic, I'd rather be sitting at least one day in four, or however many hours you're rotating through the driving seat. The question I would think of is, if I had the car, it was my car, you're allowed to charge for petrol. Are you allowed to also sort of charge for sort of part of the depreciation of the car and all the things that need to be done with it, servicing and changing tyres, etc., etc.? Are you allowed to charge, say, a quarter of that or a percentage of that to the people, as well as just petrol charges?
And I know from having been on various company car schemes when I was younger that there are ways to fiddle these things. You can add this and that and the other. Oh, well, yeah, you know, new set of tyres, brake. You can go on. So the lines of what is a legitimate expense and what is milking the system can be blurred. I'm sure the guys in Abu Dhabi are on top of this, but there is precedent.
You've also got someone who drives the same route as you at the same time as you, Richard Dean, and I will expect you tomorrow morning at 4:45 to be outside my flat to pick me up for our first carpooling experience.
Hang on. Whoa. Map of Dubai. Okay. We're in Media City here at the moment. I live in Barsha. Brandy Scott lives up towards the cycle track in Al Qudra. Who should be picking who up?
Who is happy to be in the other person's car more? If I picked you up every morning, you'd just complain about my motor.
That is true.
I've been looking at cars as well, but electric cars. And this is because Sir James Dyson, who moved his operations to Singapore to build electric cars there, has now pulled the plug. He's saying, look, we can't do it. He's saying it's too expensive and they don't know the way forward. And they make, obviously, vacuum cleaners, fans, hair dryers. That's what they're famous for. He'd set aside $2.5 billion for this project to develop his own radical motor from scratch, but they pulled the plug saying, look, we're going to carry on working on batteries, but the idea of setting up the worldwide distribution network, developing the batteries, all of the other costs is just too daunting. We can't do it. We're not going to do it. We'll spend the money in other ways. And people in Singapore, obviously, it's concerning for Singapore, because they were looking forward to having lots and lots of people employed at Dyson's Singapore car manufacturing plant. Professor Nitin Pangarkar has said that the hype over Dyson's Singapore car plant was always a load of hot air. And he said, I half expected the project not to take off. And Associate Professor Zafar Momin from the Nanyang Technical University in Singapore says he's been quite sceptical of the company's ability to pull off the venture in the first place. They've said, they both said, producing electric cars is a phenomenally complex and expensive process that to which new entrants face high entry barriers on several levels: technology, design, reliable, cost-effective supply chain, sales distribution networks, etc., etc. And they said, look, you know, Tesla's been going for 15 years and it's not profitable. You know, have you got as deep a pockets and investors as that? Can you do it? It's a bit of a blow for Singapore. He's apparently still going to live there. He bought two very expensive apartments when he got there. And it does look like he's not going to move his operations back to the UK yet. But Dyson pulling the plug, the electric plug on electric cars.
Which is interesting because it's something that the guys at Ford have told me before when they've been asked, you know, are you worried about everyone from sort of, you know, Google to whoever else climbing into the car space, autonomous cars, electric cars? Ford have said, no, we're not, because it's actually, you know, they might have the tech know-how or whatever it happens to be. It's actually really hard to make a car and then to make it en masse and deliver it and get it out there and sell it. We fortunately have been doing it for a long time, but you know, it's a lot to set up. It's one thing to have the chips or the batteries or the, you know, sort of the ingenuity, but it's another thing to actually make a car.
Dyson had hired 520 people to work on this project in Singapore. So that's the immediate blow to Singapore. There's going to be 500 people out of work.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We are having a look at optimism and whether or not we are all jumping the gun, feeling pretty good. There is positivity around a potential Brexit deal that has sent the pound shooting up, while US President Donald Trump says that he has reached a substantial phase with China over trade. We are joined now on the line by Khatija Haque, Head of MENA Research at Emirates NBD. Khatija, thanks for speaking to us. So something of a truce in the US-China trade war. Let's start there. How significant is this?
It is important because it clearly means we're not going to see any escalation from here. So if you remember, there were another set of tariffs that were supposed to come into place on the 15th of October, so this week. Those have now been delayed indefinitely. There is potential for the December tariffs as well to be delayed or cancelled. But really, this is not so much a deal as a truce, which is how you've described it. Effectively, the existing tariffs which the U.S. has placed on China remain in place. And so you still have that additional cost for U.S. companies and U.S. consumers. But at the same time, you're not going to have any escalation. And China has pledged to buy more agricultural products from the U.S., which will certainly be a boost to the farming sector there. However, it is a verbal deal only. And we've seen in the past that, you know, the U.S. and China have come very close to a deal, most recently in the first quarter of this year. And then a couple of tweets later, everything was off the table. The details are still going to be worked out over the next 3 to 5 weeks. And then the formal document is only expected to be signed in November. So a lot can happen between now and November, but certainly it is a positive step.
Khatija, there's one thing that jumped out that gave me some sort of optimism, and that was the fact that they look like they've agreed a lot to do with intellectual property and the protection thereof.
Well, that wasn't the sense that I got when I read the details of the discussion or, you know, what little was announced. It seems really to have been focused on the existing tariffs, no new tariffs imposed by the U.S., some agricultural products to be bought by China, and also perhaps some additional transparency around their currency and monetary policy. But it didn't really provide any detail on progress on things like intellectual property, on China's industrial policy, on the subsidies, on market access. So all of the really, really big issues where the two sides are very far apart and where China feels like the U.S. is wanting to impose on its own sovereignty, those issues haven't really been in the scope of these talks.
So what will you be watching for next? I mean, the new head of the IMF said that this could cost the global economy $700 billion over the next year. What are the signs that we should look out for?
Well, I think the first thing is that this deal actually gets signed. This truce or this sort of very, very limited in scope agreement actually comes into force and is signed by both parties. And then that provides a base for them to continue to talk about the other stuff, which would include then intellectual property and some of the other big concerns. But we also would like to see some indication that the U.S. may roll back some of the tariffs that have been imposed up to now, because really that's what's going to be needed to stop the additional costs that, you know, and the disruption to the supply chain that's happening because of what's been introduced over the last 18 months. And so the impact on the global growth story is going to continue to be negative from the tariffs that have already been in place. So ideally, we'd like to see some rollback of that in order to have a more upbeat outlook for the next year or so.
Right, well, let's have a look at the other big elephant in the room. Brexit, the pound surging on the hope that the UK might leave with a deal after all. Some positive-looking meetings over the weekend. Is a deal really looking likely?
I think it's a big ask at this point. I would still put a fairly low probability on the UK leaving on the 31st of October with a deal. I think what's more likely to happen is they agree on the key points of what a deal would look like, and then perhaps have an extension to thrash out the finer points of the text. And I suspect that's likely what's going to happen. However, we'll get more information at the end of the weekend, because that's when the broader EU is going to be briefed on whatever has been agreed this weekend, if indeed an agreement is reached on the key issues. And then, again, you'd need to go into a sort of a blackout period where they do a line-by-line negotiation over the text of a deal. And then, of course, that's got to be approved by not just the EU, but the British Parliament. And that, I think, is still the biggest hurdle, because the indications from what I've read is that this new proposal effectively means that Northern Ireland stays within the EU's customs union, and the rest of the UK follows a different path in terms of tariffs. And that separation of Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK's customs regime is potentially going to be very problematic for the Prime Minister to try and get Parliament to agree to. And of course, the Northern Irish have already said that's not what they are willing to accept. So, or at least the DUP have said that they're not willing to accept that. So I think that, you know, even if there is an agreement that is reached and approved by the EU, getting it through Parliament is still a massive hurdle. So I do think the probability of getting a deal before the 31st of October is quite small.
Khadija Haque from Emirates MBD, Head of MENA Research, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening. We are back tomorrow, 6 a.m. Have a lovely evening.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.